What is up? What is going on, everybody? This week, I have convinced both my co-hosts to do this entire podcast in sign language just for your listening pleasure, and we'll do it on the other side of the song. Welcome back, everyone, to another new episode of The Threequel. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Ethan Klein, and here with me, Mike Duranik. Oh, he actually is signing. Okay. And Brad Miller.
What up?
Sweet. At least two of us are going to roll with it. Well, that was much
more
less...
impressed if that was actually the correct signing for how's it going or something.
I think I actually just told you to steal second base, but I can't be totally...
I thought I knew what you were going for, but yeah. So this week we are doing my choice for the month of April, A Quiet Place, starring real-life married couple John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, also directed by Krasinski. This is now just eligible to us. As this is the five-year anniversary of it coming out in theaters, so it came out the same month as Avengers Infinity War. That was quite an April back in 2018. So let's just get into it, guys. What was your first experience with A Quiet Place? Did you catch it in theaters in that very eventful April of 2018? Did you see it later on streaming, something like that? Was this your first experience with it? What did you bring into this rewatch for the show?
I think if I am remembering correctly, I watched it with you, Ethan. I believe you had seen it, and then you suggested watching it, and I think that we had hung out maybe at the house and watched it. So pretty sure that was the first experience, because you had spoken highly of it and convinced me to go ahead and watch it.
This is the first time I have ever seen this. I'm very familiar with it. I remember the trailers for it. So I think I had a good handle on the plot line. And I distinctly actually remember the first time seeing the trailer. It had to have been in theaters, you know, leading up to this release. And the scene with them playing the board game and then the you know, lantern getting knocked over and... So the trailers, I think, did it justice in terms of building the suspense, but not one that I had ever gotten around to seeing until I watched it in preparation for this show, or this podcast.
Yeah, this was a theater viewing opening weekend for me. Went with, you know, one of my buddies at the time, and this is, again, like those previews came out, they were good previews, they did a really good job of selling the movie, but for me, and now that we've seen it, I mean, I would not classify this as a typical horror movie. This is definitely more in the thriller genre, but the preview certainly sold probably something more horror than it ended up being. And to get me in the theater for a movie of that genre, you got to give me something more. Like, I'm definitely not one of the people that you can just say, hey, here's a horror movie. Oh, cool, I'm in. There's got to be that extra thing. In this case, it was John Krasinski. It wasn't even necessarily the idea. Cool concept, but being a fan... I'm a bigger fan of John Krasinski in The Office than I am of The Office. Like, he is my favorite part of the show. I know, which seems blasphemous because everybody would just say Michael Scott, but I'm a fan of Jim in The Office. And then that flip that he made into 13 Hours, which we did a couple years ago on the podcast, made me a very big fan to see what he would continue to do. And now he's going to try to direct something. So I was very, very in on this, and I've always enjoyed Emily Blunt. So that had me locked in. I was ready to go in the theater in April of 2018, again, opening weekend, ready to see it. So before we get too much into our thoughts on the movie and Mike's first thoughts on the movie, what you're going to have to do for your first time seeing this movie is guess the Rotten Tomatoes score, and I'll have the opportunity to snipe you one way or the other. So, Mike, where is this movie sitting on the tomato meter?
Well, I wish that I was getting to snipe you, because I have no idea how high to put this. And I say it that way because I think that this movie, at least my impression is that it was pretty well received critically. I know that you tend to be a fairly rigid critic yourself, and this movie was one that I remember you raving about frequently through the last number of years. So I think it's got to be pretty high. How high is the only question. And so I'm going to put it at a 93 and let you decide the over-under on that. But I think it's got to be in the 90s somewhere.
That's the number I was so certain was going to make things impossible for Brad with Infinity War. And now you've done that to me. I'm going to say 92 because it seems so hard to get things into that upper echelon. So I'm going to play just the odds, but I'm not going to be shocked if I'm wrong. So I'm going to say 92. Mike said 93. Brad?
Well, normally I keep a pretty good poker face when I look at the score. This one got a reaction. I guess neither one of you probably noticed that, but this was a holy shit when I opened it up. It's a 96.
Okay.
So, yeah, audience quite a ways off at 83, but critics put this at 96 on the tomato meter. So one of the highest rated films we've done.
Well, so then the next question I usually ask is Rotten Tomatoes correct? And quite often when there's a huge gap between the critics and the audience, I would say more times than not, we end up being on the side of the audience. And usually that big gap in the movies we've done have come in like an action movie or something like that where the critics are like, yeah, it's fine, but it's an action movie and the audience just loved it. And we end up loving it too because of what it is. This is a pretty rare time that the gap is the critics think this is one of the best movies we've ever watched and the audience liked it. Which is surprising because I did just look it up. This movie cost $17 million to make, which is crazy how low a budget. Made $360 million right around there. So that, I mean, that is a huge successful thing. Obviously, there's A Quiet Place 2. Now there's going to be A Quiet Place 3, and they're currently making a spinoff called A Quiet Place Day 1 with an entirely different cast. Quiet Place 3 will continue this storyline. There's a whole new cast. So like this has spawned quite a bit. Very successful. 82, I'm pretty shocked at. So is Rotten Tomatoes correct? I'll emphatically say yes. This is one of the best movies we've ever watched. If you're comparing, again, we have to compare action movies a different way than we compare Good Will Hunting. This is a very different thing than Good Will Hunting. But for the genre that it's in, for the tasks they were trying to accomplish, I say absolutely yes, it's correct. And I am shocked that the audience scores where it's at. 80, there's nothing wrong with an 82. I'm baffled that it's as low as it is.
So, not that it matters. It was 83 was the score, okay. But still.
Well, especially given how much of a commercial success it was in the box office and clearing 50, 60, million for a movie of this type, especially when it was in theaters running head-to-head against Infinity War. And so, although you never know, that may have ended up helping it because people might have said, hey, it was fun going to the movies, let's go do this again. So this movie came in at 90 minutes. So I think, why are the critics right? Well, why the critics are right is that this movie, unlike so many movies we've talked about, doesn't have fat to trim. It is to the point. You are moving through the plot quickly. It is engaging. You have to really be paying attention to it because obviously it's quite quiet and you're waiting for those moments when all of a sudden there is noise, knowing that it's going to engage you in a different way. Because there's not a whole lot of spoken word, you're going very heavily based off of facial expressions and things of that nature. The acting is really well done. So I think that those are the arguments in favor of saying the critics are correct. The arguments against it, as I was watching this, and this is going to be blasphemous, but not as much as it's going to sound like, right? I found this movie to be incredibly similar in some ways to a movie like Signs, only far better done. So that's where I look at it and go, okay, so where's Signs at in this? It's better than that. I probably would have put this in the upper 80s. So again, I feel like halfway between the audience, halfway between the critics is about where it should be. But the movie was well done. There's no doubt about it.
I'm going to ask a question before I answer. How far off of a number do you have to be to say that that number's wrong? Like,
I say 5%. I say, like, you can bracket things within 5% of each other as, like, you kind of view the movie the same way. I mean, I think there is probably a pretty distinct line once you start crossing into 95 and above. So, but still, within 5%. Like, is...
Well, I'll answer this way then. We've done 117 movies after we do next week's film. So 116 counting this one. This comes in for me at number 21, which means it's really good. We've watched a lot of really good movies. And if my top 10, I'll just say, are all at a 100, because that's, you know, the movies I love the most, then the next probably 20 to 25 are somewhere in the 90s. and that falls in this category. So this definitely would be a 90s in score for me, and if you're saying 5% off still counts as agreeing, then yeah, I would have this at probably 92, 93 before playing this game. So 96 sounds pretty fair to me. I love the fact that it's so short. One of the things that, you know, you get done and you're like, I need more movies like that in my life, because you could watch two of these in the time it takes you to watch some of these films like Avatar and stuff that are coming out, and it's just, that's such a commitment to make. And I love the fact that it's different. I there was a movie on Netflix, that Bird Box film, that is similar in a lot of ways.
Came out
to
right
this
about the same time, yep.
And that too was very compelling to me. It was interesting, and this was interesting, and I can tell you why. Another thing that showed me how interesting this is, my wife does not like this genre at all, avoids it. She knew I was going to watch this, declined to sit and watch with me, but I had it on in the living room. She was cooking, doing different things, and much like The Walking Dead did for her, she noticed that it was quiet, and that got her attention, because I think it piqued her interest. Well, oh, this is different. They're not saying anything. And I'd glance over, and I saw her watching more and engaging more, and then she says she's studying and doing stuff, but I could see her, like, looking over the screen at the TV, so I knew that even someone that has no interest in this was being pulled in. Now, also, the relationship to The Office, right. Emily Blunt's ability to have you connect with her, the kids they chose for the roles, all done really well. So yeah, this movie's a home run. And by putting it at 21, that is not a knock in any way. That's to be in a top 25 of movies that we've watched, says this is really, really good quality film. So yeah, loved it and glad we watched it.
Yeah, I think, and what I appreciate too, what you guys mentioned, like with the running time, this is, for being a genre movie like this that's hard to pull people in, and I mean, Brad, you said that the first time you saw it was because you and I watched it together and I had said some things. Thinking back, every time I've seen this movie after the first time, it has been to show someone this movie. Except for, well, no, because I didn't rewatch it within the last week, because I just watched it over Christmas with my girlfriend's family, because I convinced all of them to watch it for the first time, because I knew that people would enjoy it, even though nobody in her family likes horror movies. Same thing with when I got my dad to watch this for the first time, my mom, I got my grandma to watch this movie because she thinks John Krasinski's cute. She mentioned, she said something, she's like, that couple, that John guy and that Emily Blunt, they're so cute. I'm like, if you think they're cute, grandma, let's watch this. And she loved it. What? Because again, like, yes, it's a genre movie, but they do such a good job. And that's why, like what you just said with getting your wife involved in it, the fact that my grandmother was willing to, like, get involved in this movie, John Krasinski is going to, at the very least, be nominated for an Academy Award at some point in his life, whether it's in front of or behind the camera. The fact that his first directorial effort is something where a horror movie can bring in anybody, and again, we've said it's more thriller than horror, but it's still scary at times. It's terrifying, but the tricks and the turns that they pull on you as an audience, not that there's a surprise in the story, but the most horrifying thing that shows up in this movie is a nail sticking out of a stair, right? Like, it's not a monster. It's, as soon as that nail pulls up, you're now stressed for the next 25, 30 minutes, however long it takes, because you know someone's going to step on a nail at some point. There's creatures out there that can move at, you know, whatever, 50 miles an hour and cut you in half with their arm, but the scariest thing, the thing you're most stressed about, is who's going to step on a nail. And that is just credit to writing and direction and storytelling and tension building, well, all because of that.
Also, because you understand that pain.
Yes.
I don't understand what it's like to be afraid of an alien monster right. coming at me and slicing me in half. But the stress of that nail, like you said, oh yeah, I was like, oh no. Like, and you just like, hand over your mouth sort of moment, like when she's walking down the steps. And yeah, just crazy how that little thing in that,
this is why
made such a difference.
I love, and I'm so glad that we're getting back into, like, people are going to the movies again, and this is why I love going
to
the
movies. Thank you, Tom
Cruise. Yes. Thank you, Top Gun, for saving us all. Have you guys seen Top Gun Maverick yet?
Yes.
I have not.
It, I mean, It's amazing.
Well, but in fairness, I hadn't seen Top Gun until we watched it for this podcast, remember?
So Top Gun Maverick makes Top Gun look like one of the worst movies of all time with how good it is. I love Top Gun Maverick.
I've heard great things.
We'll go down a rabbit hole that I can't stop with how much I love Top Gun Maverick. Anyways, I'm so glad we're back to seeing movies in theaters because this was one of those, I'll never forget my theater experience with this. Like, I'll go see a movie by myself on a Tuesday night just to catch up. If it's something that I know Tess doesn't want to see it, I'll just go catch it by myself because I have a free night, whatever. But there's not anything that can top a packed theater on opening night and feeling the experience of seeing a movie for the first time with 200 other people. And this is one of those ones I always remember because when she stepped on that nail, it was the collective in unison, all 200 of us, like, oh shit, like, over a nail. But again, we all knew what that felt
like. But also the
like.
Tension knowing that she's going to step on this and she can't make a sound.
Right.
And the baby's there, you know, like it's crazy. Like,
yeah, and I give them credit. Have either of you seen, well, you, I know you haven't, because this is the first time you've seen this one. Have you seen the second one?
I have not.
Okay.
No, I've seen the second one.
Well, actually, that's not, because I made Tess go see the second one the first summer we were together, and she had yet to see the first one.
Well, so. He's like, you know, John Krasinski, don't want to see it. He's not in the second one.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go watch it.
Well, that guy. So the second one opens with the day that they hit. The first 15 minutes is like the moment that the aliens land, so he's in it. Uh-huh. And then it jumps to right after the end of this one, and Tess, she's like, why'd they leave Krasinski behind? It's like, oh, you didn't see the first one. Sorry. But what I appreciate, the second one, an hour and 37 minutes. Like, they did not, so often people will just like morph their storytelling into like, well, this made $300 million, so now it has to be 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And there has to be 6 more action sets. Like, that's a credit to his filmmaking too, that they did that. And I think, honestly, the second one's just as good as this one is. But focusing on this one, I think it is such a unique story. They do such a good job, not just with that nail, but something like, it's just such a simple idea of, okay, we're going to make a movie where you have to be quiet or you die. And someone's going to be 9 months pregnant. Well, how do you do, like, that makes no sense. But the way they do it, like, we all nitpick certain things in movies and stuff like that. It's hard to nitpick a world that we'll never be a part of, because how do you really explain, like, that wouldn't work, that's not our world. But if there's a way to have a baby and not make any noise, I love all the ways that they did that. And I love, we're going to go down to the river and a father and son can have a father and son moment because the river is louder than we are. We're going to fire off fireworks because those are loud enough that your mom can go through child having a child because the distractions are, like, all those little things that they put together, I think played out perfectly, and I never had a problem with any of them.
I have a problem with, if we're getting into this, the logic,
sure, yeah,
of why not go move and live by a waterfall?
Right, yes.
Why have to go on this adventure to have these moments when just go live by something loud? So you can interact with your family on a normal basis. You can have a child. Like, the second she realizes she's pregnant, Krasinski might want to say, hey, you know, let's go move over by this loud moving thing so we can be safe. But anyways, I digress. Yeah. It would have taken away from those moments in the film, but, yeah, go live by a waterfall.
Yes. So aside from their living choice, I was more focused on how they lived in the world they were in. And I think, like, just the idea that you have to keep a towel down when you wash your face because you can't let the water drip down. Like, all those things I just thought were really unique and really well thought out.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah.
The towel thing.
No silverware. They're eating off a lettuce plate because they don't have plate. Like, just all that stuff I just thought was really, really well done. And I think one of the things that they did a really good job of is the opening of the movie. I'm curious, you, since you're the freshest to see this for the first time, how shocked were you at the opening with the little boy? Because I remember that was like, oh, like, that's what this movie is.
Well, I figured that the little boy was a goner when he grabbed the batteries.
Right.
Like, you know, at that point it was a matter, whether it was quick or whether it was later in the movie, there was no way that those batteries didn't come back to end up biting him. So I wasn't shocked. And but what I will say is I thought that it was skillfully done, because again, to your point, that this is not a horror so much as a suspense thriller type thing. The way that they did the little boy's death, with you can see the thing kind of coming, but you don't get a clear shot at it. You don't know exactly what it is, and really you're just playing off of the faces of the siblings, the faces of the mother. Krasinski's face as he's running towards the kid, and then has that moment of realization that there's nothing he can do. I think that again, not showing, showed so much.
Yep.
And so it didn't shock me, but it was very well done. And what it did do is say, oh, okay, this movie has a lot going for it, beyond the creatures, beyond the, you know, the suspense in that way, in terms of the acting.
Well, and probably the best work that they do, and we can fold this into kind of, I'll ask you guys, like, who you think the MVP of the movie is. The work that they do with Millicent Simmons as the daughter, mm-hmm. is amazing. The choice to have the character be deaf, she is also deaf in real life. Krasinski actually, I don't know how much you guys looked into this, but Krasinski made everybody that was going to work on the movie learn sign language and be able to communicate in sign language so that they could communicate with her effectively, and everybody could do it, not just him and Emily, but like everybody on set. And the idea of what can kill you is the sound you make, and you have no idea if you're making sound. I think that was a genius move to have that be a part of this. And I think she did an amazing job. Those scenes between him and her, mm-hmm. are fantastic all the way up to the last scene that they have together. But I guess I'll fold that into then this as well. Who do you guys think wins the entire movie?
Well, I think I have to go with Krasinski, but not even 100% for his acting in this, but as I was, again, reading up on this, he did the motion captures for the alien creatures. Like, he was all in this movie. And so it's hard, they all did such a good job. It's such a small, tight-knit cast. But it's hard to see this as anything other than an MVP effort by him when you take into account everything he did. You know, like as you just mentioned, saying, okay, we're intentionally going to cast a deaf actress for this role, and I'm going to make sure everybody learns how to communicate with her, doing the motion captures himself for the alien creatures. I mean, it's a tour de force.
Yep.
I'll go off the beaten path. I'm going to say Neil Young, because one of the most memorable things in this is them playing his song on the headphones, and it's one of the only things that you get sound wise through the whole thing, and it's memorable. Like it makes you realize how important music is. It makes you realize how much you crave stuff like that. And perfect song choice, whoever chose that song right there for them to kind of have that moment with. Great job. So I'll go with Neil Young.
Well, in credit, I mean, if you're gonna have a movie where you need to have chemistry with someone and you can never talk, you might as well cast your wife. But it works, mm-hmm. and they're fantastic together. I mean, I've kind of skipped over, we talked about John Krasinski with 13 Hours, and I don't see how anybody could say that this isn't his peak. In the movie world, sure, so there's going
to... Jim from The Office.
Yeah, that's going to be that. But in the movie world, like you just said, you can't top everything that he did for this movie. So... there's that Emily Blunt side of it. I've always been a huge fan of hers, and I don't think we've ever talked about her. But also, too, again, with this, I know that there's probably some people that are diehard Mary Poppins fans, but again, it's not unfair to say that the best performance you give is when you're being in love with your actual husband, right? Like, there's just a different level that you get to do.
It worked for them, but I just need to make sure we're clear. Like, in the event that my wife was an actress and needed on-set chemistry in complete silence with somebody, she would clearly cast Dave Matthews and not me.
Well, and if the only person I think that would pick Mary Poppins over this is Pappy Drew.
Probably.
And he needs to die hard, so, yeah.
That was almost an option for next month, was Die Hard.
Ooh. There you go.
That was the third one. Which may be the best one. Who knows? Some people would say. Anyways, for this, yeah, it's just really, really hard. It would be really hard for them to top what they did here. Again, I think the second one is almost just as good of a movie, but it's for a very different reason. I think they make a lot of different choices that end up working, because they had to, because obviously Krasinski isn't in that one. At what point watching this movie, excuse me, the first time, did you guys think there was a chance that Krasinski might not make it out? Or were you just shocked right up until the moment that it happened?
Again, having not seen it in the theater, I think if I had seen it in the theater and not known anything at all about the movie, I probably would have had more shock in the moment when I realized, oh, he's going to die. For whatever reason, I think that I knew that he died, and so or at least I had convinced myself that I knew that he died, and so it was not a matter of if, it was a matter of when and how. Still, the scene was impactful. It didn't it didn't take away from the impact of it. It was extremely well done. I for whatever reason just entered this movie knowing, whether I actually knew or whether I just imagined it, that he was going to die.
It would have been a disappointment and not as good a movie if he didn't. I mean, they set up the whole thing with the relationship with the strained relationship with his daughter, that at some point he had to sacrifice himself for her. Like, it was just kind of set up that way from the beginning. So, I think it would have taken away from it had that not happened.
Yeah, I agree. I remember being in the theater, and when he gets hit by the thing, I thought he was dead. And was upset that would be how he died. And then when he stood up, I realized that it was about to be so much worse. It kind of just... For the sake of the movie, yes, the way it played out was perfect. That's a chef's kiss. That's perfect filmmaking. For my emotional security, it would have just been so much better if he would have died from the first hit and I didn't have to see what came next. I know. I mean, I say a lot. Like, I am. It's very easy to make me cry in a movie. You get anything involving parents and their kids, I'm probably going to be gone for, whatever. But there's much like, you know, there's 35 movies in my top 10. There's a difference between, I get choked up at almost anything, but the actual tears flowing down the face, that takes a little bit more effort. This was one of the times in the theater I was toast. There was no stopping it. And really, it's the scream that he lets out, which is so strange to give someone credit for screaming, but that is such a, again, for a movie where there's not that much sound, you can feel him saying that he loves his kids in a scream, which is really weird, and maybe some people don't see it that way, but that in his face, in his acting, all that, I just think that it was really, really well done. It's one of the better deaths that I think we've talked about.
Well, and that scream says, one, I'm protecting you. Two, yeah. I love you. And three, I know I'm never going to see you again.
Right.
You know, like, there's just so many layers to how he did that. And the noise with how he did his face was, it was great.
It felt like he was screaming for her to hear, even though she couldn't. In a way, like that. So I've always taken that. So let's do favorite line, favorite scene. I know there's not that much talking. I think I'll just kind of take it because we just were there talking about it. I'm going to say favorite line as what he signed to her. I think that's absolutely the best. I've loved you, I've always loved you. Like that, him signing that, and even though it just comes up as subtitles on the screen, that was one of those moments where they didn't even need subtitles. Like, I don't know sign language, but I knew what he was about to say to her.
Mm-hmm.
Because they set that up with his son saying, you should tell her more often that you don't think that it's her fault. And I think, like, the way that played out, like, not that I have kids of my own, but we've all had situations where we think how we feel is very obvious, but we don't say it enough. And that's what, like, he's almost offended that his son would ask him if he thinks it's her fault that the other son died. But then you see it from a kid's perspective. Of course that's what she thinks. If they've never had that conversation, he thinks it's obvious because he's looking at it from an adult, but not from a 12-year-old, however old she's supposed to be, little girl, whose dad has just never said, like, hey, you're fine. And so the way that comes through, I think that's the best line, is him signing, I love you, I've always loved you.
Yeah, I think that it is, that's a perfectly good choice. I don't have anything better than it. You know, it's tough in this one because so much of it, the dialogue is signed.
Yep.
When they do use, you know, words, it's intentional and obviously very scene specific. we talked about the scream. I almost feel like, you know, his scream could have an argument for best line, just given, as Brad mentioned, all of the myriad of emotions and purposes behind it. So,
yeah, I'm shocked that there were so many lines in this film to choose from that we'd all pick the same one. Yeah. So, I put Sign Language, I Love You, and the scream. I incorporate the scream with that too. So,
Favorite scene? Is it just going to be Is it just that? Like, is it his death scene, or do you guys have somewhere
that's
else?
Not mine, no.
Okay, I don't even know if that's mine, but so I'm curious then.
Mine's the tension with the nail.
Okay.
When she steps on it and then gasps quietly, and then the subsequent following of that. That's the scene, because you're waiting for it, and then it happens, and you're just like, you know, you're tense, like, you know, please don't scream. And so, yeah, mine's the nail in the foot.
Yeah, I was going nail in the foot as well. So I think, but it's a 1 and 1A in between the nail in the foot and then the signing of I love you, I've always loved you.
I agree completely. It's those. I think if there's like some honorable mention, it would be him running into the house after they set the firework off, and the tension of, you know, she's not dead. There's still a half hour left of this movie. She's not going to die off screen giving birth, but you're waiting, and then that hand goes up on the shower door. Like, that's a very, like, oh my God, like, okay, she's okay. Like, and they do a really good job of selling that. And then I think the most horrifying scene is what gets so forgotten about, because it does feel kind of random, but it has an important place in it, is the old man committing suicide by alien.
Mm-hmm.
That is, when they're walking through the woods and that old man standing there and the look on his face, because you know as soon as you see him, you're like, please don't. Don't scream. Don't make... But you also know, like, oh my God. Like, this guy's about to just... He's made this decision. He does not care who's around. And just how terrified... Because John Krasinski, you buy him as, like, a strong... Like, that is going to do anything to defend his family, and he will. But he is scared of that old man, because he knows that he has no control. Like, I think that's the scariest scene in the whole movie. And much like John Krasinski screamed, but for a very different reason, that old guy's got a really good scream, and it scared the hell out of me. So that is our favorite line, favorite scene. Pretty rare that we would all just, like, clean sweep it for both. But, again, it's an hour and a half movie.
Well, we didn't clean sweep the scene, because you picked the old man, didn't you?
No, I agreed with you guys. I just wanted to just add to the conversation, give some other things. But, yes, no, I agree. It's the nail going through the foot, which... What Home Alone made funny, this movie made terrifying. But that will do it. That is our conversation. My choice for the month of April, A Quiet Place, Part 1. Now it is officially known because they're in parts now. Next week, we will wrap up the month of April with Mike's pick. And maybe there was something else that was setting the summer blockbuster calendar ahead long before Avengers Infinity War did it. And it is Fast 5. Mike's pick for the month of April. We're going into the Fast and Furious franchise for the first time. Honestly, kind of surprised that it's taken us this long, but we're there. We're going to be revving the engines next week. Thank you so much for supporting the show, guys. Other than that, for Mike, for Brad, I'm Ethan, and we'll see you next time.